Okay, so Lecture 24, November 13th, Lecture Notes pages 211. If I seem any more goofier than I usually see, I'm at the tail part of a horrific cold that fortunately happened over the holiday. But man, I was down and out Friday and Saturday, and people were trying to get their tests done and they wanted help, and I'm going, so I'm still not 100%. So no wet kisses after class. Nope, no way. All right, so here we are, chunking along through November. Monday the 13th, lecture 24. Tomorrow on this regular schedule, mini test 12 of 13 will open. It'll close the week, the Sunday before Thanksgiving. And then we get Thanksgiving break, end of next week. So, mini test 11 closed Sunday on its usual schedule. Average score 88%. Meh, okay. And 12 will open Tuesday and close Sunday. It'll cover lectures 23 and 24, as we usually do. Then if you look ahead a bit, you can see the next exam that will open on Tuesday won't have you do anything over Thanksgiving. If you don't want to, it'll close that following Tuesday. Hidden behind the arrow. So there are two more graded mini tests, 12 and 13. But then there's material after 13 that's still going to be on the final exam, but it's not a graded mini test. So that material will come up in something called mini test 14 review only. So it'll close whatever we get through on the last day of class. It'll close. You can use that to study the rest of the material if you want, if you're using the review tests for the final. So that's an ungraded one still to come after mini test 13. Advanced earning extra credit number 8 closed last week. Average score 0.27, which is pretty consistent. So on average, you've added over 2% to your final course grade. Not too shabby. 9 and 10 are still to go. So business in the news reports on a little interesting study. We talked about being in the age of experience today. People like to buy experiences, but there's issues and problems with everything, okay? The fun things in life are giving us buyer's remorse. You know, that's that idea about dissonance. We're unhappy with our purchase. Could we have done better? As the cost of having fun goes up, so do the odds that you'll feel let down. So we're trying to understand consumers' behaviors and attitudes these days in terms of the experiences they're buying. Isa Jones paid $375 for a ticket to a local music festival, more than twice what she remembers paying more than a decade ago. It's like my happy place, she said. That justifies the expense. But midway through the three-day festival, she felt she wasn't really getting $375 worth of fun. Yeah, it was more like $200 worth of fun. She said, the price keeps going up, but nothing about the experience gets any better. So what does this mean for us in the age of experience? Anybody had a service like that? I don't know what it would be. Price has gone up a lot for the service, but you're just not having that much more fun to it? Nobody? One or two people? So the cost of admissions and fees for entertainment rose faster than the cost of many staple goods last year. That has helped to raise standards for the amount of fun we expect for our money and triggered quick disappointment when our experiences don't live up to that price. So if you remember back from understanding consumer behavior, satisfaction is equal to answering the question, does the perceived experience meet our expectations? With that kind of price, it better be a lot of fun. Well, wait a minute, it wasn't that much more fun. If pricey experiences can't live up to their own hype, the answer isn't to give up on going to shows or traveling or having those experiences. Instead, you might want to just look for cheaper pleasures, says this guy out at UT Austin. You might go to an expensive tasting menu and have an exquisite meal at a fine dining restaurant, but you know what? Some of the best stories you might have might be about that hole-in-the-wall restaurant that you just happened to cross. So maybe you change your behavior as consumers, set your expectations differently. Interestingly, in general, people report enjoying more expensive purchases more. Here they mean product, I think. Oh, I see. They're making a point. In general, people report more expense, enjoying more expensive purchases more, but the relationship between price and satisfaction isn't as strong for experiences as it is for products. So almost everybody who buys a more expensive product feels like it was worth it. If you're driving a BMW or a Chevy, everybody thinks the BMW is better. It's a better product. But for experiences, it's not quite that clear cut. With prices for both material goods and experiences running high, people might be less likely to regret their spending if they shifted more of it to the experience side of the ledger, where maybe it is better, maybe it isn't better, but there's some room to play with. So here's the impact of economic factors on consumer satisfaction. Just something to play with in your head. Still going on about Bud Light. We already talked about it once or twice this semester, I presume. It's been a big deal recently. Bud Light partners with Zach Bryan. How many people know Zach? Around Super Bowl 58, Bud Light is strengthening its country music ties through a partnership with musician Zach Bryan. Bryan will headline the brand's concert event slated for the weekend of Super Bowl 58 and kick off the second year of the Bud Light Backyard Tour. So, who's our target market? How can we appeal to them gooder? So we're appealing to our target market with country music, and we've got a little celebrity partnership going on. The Bud Light Backyard Tour presents Zach Bryan. It will take place February 9th at the Chelsea at the Cosmopolitan of Las Vegas, with the tie-up also inclusive of giveaways and a partnership with not-profit Folds of Honor, which provides educational scholarships to families of fallen and disabled first responders and service members. So here we see the brand still doing a bit of social responsible marketing, but choosing their partner, I think, a little more carefully to appeal to their target audience than they did with the one that got them in trouble, if you know what I'm alluding to. If not, I'm about to mention it. The partnership comes as Anheuser-Busch InBev brand seeks to further repair its standing following its controversy around its partnership with transgender influencer Dallin Mulvaney earlier this year. Not clear that the target audience really liked the hookup with the transgender influencer. In fact, it's very clear they didn't like that hookup. So earlier this year, leadership declared that Bud Light going forward, which focused more on its core consumer base's main interests, like beer, football, and music, cornerstones that the Bryan partnership touches on. So the focus is on the target market values. So we talk about being socially responsible and doing what's right for the community, et cetera, but it also has to match your target audience's interests. And if it goes directly against them and you irk them, annoy them, or piss them off, that's not going to work well. There are other things you could have done instead of that thing. According to Anheuser-InBev, 40% of lapsed Bud Light drinkers are debating on returning to the brand, but their revenue declined 13.5% in the U.S. during that period when people were thinking about it. So here's my comment. Don't annoy your heavy key users. The tie-up with Bryan sees the brand entering the second year of its Bud Light Backyard Tour series that expands on the brand's easy-to-drink, easy-to-enjoy platform. The Bud Light Backyard Tour this year offered consumers a slew of musical performances through the summer and college football season as we're trying to reappeal to our target audience and say, hey, you liked us before, you like us now, don't worry about that other thing we did. Here's some new stuff to think about. So, campaign theme and getting consumers back if they can, but it takes a bit of time. Finally, I am, as you probably have guessed, not that well hooked into a lot of pop culture, but this might not be something you know either. How many of you guys know the original Good Burger movie? Is that what I want to say? Movie? How many do know it? See, I'm unhooked entirely. I was thinking you guys wouldn't know what the hell I was talking about, because I don't know what the hell I'm talking about, which is often what you tell me. You don't know what you're talking about. So here we go. Arby's Good Burger collaboration. The fictional meal comes to restaurants as the sequel hits Paramount Plus. Did you know there was a sequel? Oh, you did. Arby's is looking to make its limited media budget work harder than the typical TV commercial through a co-branded campaign with the sequel to Good Burger that will allow fans of the cult classic to experience a meal from the fictional fast food chain. So we're doing co-branded marketing. The sequel to the 1997 Nickelodeon movie will stream on Paramount Plus beginning November 22nd, and Arby's saw Good Burger 2 as an opportunity to serve up its own burger to a younger consumer demographic. So we're trying to broaden our audience appeal with this new burger we're having. The Good Burger 2 meal features Arby's deluxe Wagyu steakhouse burger with crinkle cut fries and a new strawberry shake that pays homage to the numerous Good Burger shenanigans that involve the fictional restaurant's own dessert. And either you're laughing because you know what this is all about, or you're going like me, what are you talking about? But I assume this is funny. So connecting the brand to pop culture and humor in advertising, the effort is a way for Arby's to make its media spend more impactful by aligning the return of its burger with a specific moment in the culture rather than running a typical TV campaign. The co-branded campaign will also include traditional media elements such as a collection of ad spots, social assets, out-of-home creative, as well as an exclusive merch and takeover of one of Arby's Atlanta locations where they're actually going to turn it into a Good Burger place. And when you come in, people will ask you if you want a Good Burger, etc. So they're really going to do that particular location up. Arby's will also run TV spots to support that campaign. The ad melds the worlds of Arby and Good Burger, putting Arby's ad narrator, Bing Rams alongside the trippy fast food puppets from the world of Good Burger 2. So a couple of their trippy.
Reasons number 4 and 5 to bring your film production to Illinois, the tax credit.
A Good Burger 2 meal at Arby's? Is this a dream?
No, it isn't. Isn't that right, talking strawberry shake?
Yep. Right, talking hat sign?
Totally real.
Arby's.
So, either you get it or you don't. I'm still not getting it. So, sound went out. I wondered louder.
Strawberry shake from Arby's.
Ah.
Good crinkle fries from Arby's.
Ooh. Is this a collab for Good Burger too?
Quiet, you. Arby's, we have the meat.
So, if you see these ads running, that's what it's all about. All right, back to finishing off pricing. Lecture notes, page 211, and chapter 14, page 399 in the textbook. We left off it. We sometimes do an awkward place to break. We were talking about this idea of dynamic pricing, and we just ran out of time. The notion was that the old way of doing stuff, you picked a price, it stayed around for a long time, not just hours, days, weeks, months. These days, we can watch what's going on in the consumer environment, see what the worth of the particular product is at different times, and switch it around. So why do we use dynamic pricing? Well, the notion is that beyond the point where we've covered our costs as the number of price points relative to an existing fixed price level increase, so do the potential profits. So our notion is that we have a cost that doesn't change from our perspective. We have a price point that covers our costs, and so now we have profit, but there's nothing in here. This is all past stuff, past up profit. And so the notion is if you can find a way to make this thing work here, you can pick up extra profit along the way. So with more than one price or changing prices, as long as people will buy at it, you actually have the opportunity to pick up prices or pick up profit. Let's hear them explain it, see if they make more sense for you than I do.
Amazon's tremendous success in many ways flips back to the reputation it has earned as a low-cost player in the retail world. 95% of beauty products are priced lower on Amazon than any other online retailer. The same is true for 90% of hair care products and even 81% of low-margin personal care products. Amazon keeps its prices low through a variety of mechanisms. A key component about the platform is that both Amazon itself can sell its own inventory, and millions of third-party merchants can sell theirs on the same platform. Amazon prices its inventory using a unique price-matching crawler that scans e-tailers across the web to find the lowest prices for a product. Amazon then uses this information to price its own products to ensure that it is always offering the lowest prices. Amazon is currently estimated to adjust its prices more than 2.5 million times per day. It does this for products of both brands that have chosen to officially distribute on Amazon, such as Procter & Gamble's Olay, as well as those who have not, for example, Estee Lauder. Amazon's third-party marketplace also ensures that prices stay low on the platform. A key component is that multiple merchants can sell the same product. These merchants, however, have to compete to win the buy box on a listing. Amazon's buy box algorithm considers many seller factors when trying to decide who wins a listing. Many of these are based on past seller performance, such as total sales volume or reviews. However, price is also strongly considered and is the factor over which a third-party merchant has the most immediate influence. A classic invisible hand scenario, the level of competition in a sector, the number of suppliers offering a particular product, is strongly correlated with the average discount available for that product. Third-party pricing on Amazon feeds back into the price crawler that Amazon uses to determine the pricing on its own inventory, so the activity of third-party merchants helps keep Amazon's own prices low.
Now, I think there's been some recent legal criticism of this approach to doing pricing and whether or not it harms competition, but that's what they've been doing so far. So speaking of legal questions, let's see how we can get ourselves into legal trouble with your pricing. One of the easiest places to get into trouble with the law is with your pricing. So one approach is to work with your other competitors to set the price of the product. So you're not competing with one another. So we agree with the competitor what price everyone will pay. That's called price fixing. It's illegal. Gee, who would do that? Well, how about Pilgrim's Pride, who agreed to pay $110 million to settle charges of fixing chicken prices with their competition. Pilgrim's Pride, one of the largest poultry producers in the United States, said it would pay $110 million to settle federal charges that it had helped fix prices and then passed on higher costs for chicken to consumers, restaurants, and supermarkets. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, don't set prices with your competition. It's illegal. How common is this? Well, pretty common. Here are current parent companies and subsidiaries with over $1 billion in price fixing penalties. Between January of 2000 and March of 2023, Visa, Deutsche Bank, Barclays, Master, Card, Citigroup, Teva Pharmaceuticals, UBS, JP Morgan, National Wealth Group, American International, AbbVie, Kinder Morgan, Samsung, LG, Microsoft, NRG, etc. So, what can I say? Don't do that, it's illegal. Also, you can get in trouble by engaging in price discrimination. This is charging different prices to buyers when there are no differences in the grade of the product, the quality of the product, or the cost of the product that results in substantial lessening of competition. This might be a head scratch off your top of your head. You might think back to, I think we were talking about buying cars or airplane seats. And we know pretty much that people don't pay the same price for the cars they buy or for the airplane seats they ride in. The grade, the quality, the cost of the goods are pretty much the same, yet we know that this happens all the time. Is that illegal? No? Yes? What all these car dealers and airplanes are doing, is that illegal? Why not? Why? Toyota is a Toyota. Airplane seat's an airplane seat.
What's the second part of the sentence say? Webby, can you see the second part of the sentence there?
Yo! Oh, because it doesn't lessen competition. That's the rest of the thought. So, you know, they're all doing it. It's not cheating the people over there by doing it differently. So that part isn't illegal, but if it lessened competition, it would be a problem. Deceptive pricing. So bait and switch. That's the idea where you say, hey, come on into my electronic shop. I'm going to sell you a flat screen TV, 65 inches for $150. Whoa. I'm in on that. And when you get there, what do they say? You know what? That's sold out. We don't have that one. Here's one for $890, though. Wait a minute. That's not why I came in. FTC sues TurboTax. You guys know TurboTax. Maker of Intuit over bait and switch ads. Bada bink, bada boom. Suing TurboTax, saying the ads for its free tax filing misled consumers. What they said was free, wasn't really available for your situation ever. So don't do that. Now what you can do, by the way, is say, come in, I have a limited quantity at this price. I have 10 units, 7 units at this price. That's not considered bait and switch. You've told them that. One unit and it's not here today is bait and switch. Bargains conditioned on purchases of overpriced products is considered deceptive pricing. So, hey, you're going to sell this part of the deal really cheaply, but everything else is overpriced, not so good. Fake sales off of prices never really offered. So you go into a store and you're going to buy a nice suit, nice dress, and it says 60% off. Manufacturer suggested retail price. Ooh, that's probably a pretty good deal. But of course, it turns out that nobody ever sells the product at the manufacturer's suggested retail price. That would be considered deceptive pricing. Boohoo brands accused of deceptive pricing. They are going to pay $4.75 million to resolve 3 class action lawsuits, which claims they misled consumers with deceptively inflated prices that they then discounted from. Now, sometimes where retail stores are trying to be a bit honest, they'll say 60% off a manufacturer's suggested retail price, fine print. These products may never have been offered at the manufacturer's suggested retail price in our stores. Okay, at least you're disclosing that you never sold it at the actual retail price, so the 60% off is not exactly accurate. Engage in predatory pricing, having low prices to drive out competition and then raise prices. Wait a minute. When Walmart comes to town, don't they have really low prices? Don't they drive out a lot of local competition? Why are they allowed to do that? Why isn't that predatory pricing? Yes. There you go. She read the second half of the sentence. I'm so proud. So, yes, indeed. The rest of it is because they don't then come back and raise their prices up, having driven out competition. That would be illegal. That would be predatory pricing. Very good. Thank you. There's a bunch more stuff in the book, and eventually you take a biz law course, so I'm not going to go over all this stuff, but the government is concerned about how businesses use pricing, engage in competition, etc. And so we see vertical price fixing, horizontal price fixing, predatory pricing, deceptive pricing, geographical pricing against certain rules, and price discrimination are all out there. Read up on them. All right. So there we go. That ends our discussion of pricing, the second P of the marketing mix from our perspective. So we talked about products and services. We've talked about pricing. We now move on to the third of the P's of the marketing mix, the things that we can manipulate to try to satisfy consumers' needs, wants, and desires at a profit, but through an integrated effort of the firm. And so we're going to talk about managing marketing channels and supply chains, perhaps around lecture notes, page 215-ish, chapter 15 in the book. So one more time, we're down as low as we get into the weeds, the 10,000 foot level above what you do every day. Products and services done, pricing done. Now we talk about distribution. Reminder, where we stand here. Boom. With the consumer as the center of what's going on. We all became hyper aware of channels of distribution, place, supply chain during the pandemic. The supply chain is how we get nearly all of the stuff in our lives that we want and need. It's a system that helps make and deliver our favorite products. It involves, well, the manufacturer of these products and the companies that supply materials to create those products and the cargo ships, the trains, the trucks that deliver them and the stores selling them. That's all part of the supply chain. We don't think about it because it almost always works great. But it's a complex network of various different entities that are working together in order to enable us as consumers to receive our products in the time that we expect. And typically, they're not owned by the same company or corporation. They're all independent entities that work together to make this happen for us. Holy mackerel when you think about it. The pandemic disrupted nearly every aspect of the global supply chain. It's not clear that it's entirely back. Many factories, especially in China and South Korea, shut down or were forced to reduce production because their workers were sick or in lockdown. In response, then, shipping companies cut their schedules in anticipation of a drop in demand for moving goods around the world. That turned out to be a terrible mistake because Americans took the money that they used to spend outside the home and redirected it to goods for their home, which was suddenly doubling as offices and classrooms. So now there's a huge surge in demand for products, and the supply chain doesn't have any ability to supply them. So it has a clog in the system for transporting goods to the factories that needed them. At the same time, the finished products, many of them made in China, piled up in warehouses and at ports because of a profound shortage of shipping containers. At the same time, truck drivers and dock workers were stuck in quarantine, reducing the availability of people to unload goods and further slowing down the process. The pandemic made supply and demand extremely volatile. It was shifting faster than the supply chain could adjust. I digress a little bit to say, right now we have supply chain. Anybody have the course that we have in the college called supply chain or supply chain management? Everybody take that course? So there is such a course. The dean of the college is so concerned about this topic that she's thinking seriously about making it a core requirement for all business majors. You'll have to take supply chain management. We'll see if that comes to fruition or not, but man, she's hep because of something you don't think of very much. Turns out to be a me. How many of you guys had a supply chain shortage during the pandemic of something? You guys would call anything? Two of you. All right, well, the rest of you live in a nice world, I guess, but a bunch of us couldn't find everything we wanted. No one's parents were freaking out about toilet paper? Okay, well, all right. The pandemic resulted in remarkable shifts in supply and demand. Toilet paper, underlying demand did not change, but how people consumed, that's an odd word, consumed toilet paper did change. Businesses, hotels, and restaurants were closed, and suddenly people were consuming their toilet paper at home. What's so odd about that? Well, institutional toilet paper uses different brands. They have different diameter rolls. They have different quantities. The retail supply chain wasn't set up for that shift. And people at home wanted some control, and they began to hoard toilet paper. So a shift in how consumption happened, plus an increase in demand because people were hoarding toilet paper, resulted in empty toilet paper shelves in the store. Ouch. Bicycles got in short supply. Many bikes were made in China, but they were under lockdown, so bicycles were not made. They didn't get shipped to the distribution centers in March and April of 2021, so there was a supply shortage. Add to that, there were a lot of people at home. They wanted to get outside and do something that they couldn't do, that they could do socially distant. So the demand for bikes went up a lot. There was less supply, a whole lot more demand, and that's why the reason you could walk into a Walmart and not see many bikes on the shelf. So the pandemic has resulted in remarkable shifts in supply and demand. We presume there's going to be more and more reshoring. You've heard of offshoring? Reshoring of items. We think that there's going to be a move away from focusing on something we talked about earlier, just in time, and we'll talk about it again, and just in sequence manufacturing, the shift to online omnichannel retailing, upcoming in chapter 17, will continue. So we're going to see consumers want curbside pickup, shipping from the store, getting your groceries delivered. That's changed for a lot of firms, and it's going to be something where firms are going to have to be making investments as consumers, we believe, stay with these things that were enhanced by the pandemic. Supply chains will be going digital, but maybe moving slowly. Prior to the pandemic, there was still a lot of paper in the supply chains. Invoices and shipping documents were still done on paper. People had to sign for things, particularly in big corporate shipments. That's going to shift quite a bit, but you're still going to need people to help manage the shift to digital, make sure there's still good control of this sort of stuff in your supply chain. Having a strong, resilient supply chain is really important. Firms are going to be making investments in that, so it's going to become more and more visible and perhaps a core course in business. We'll see. All right, let's return to the non-pandemic view of the world and supply chains. And let's go back and think about this idea of supply chains in the old days. Again, these are, in the old days, not a single entity owning all of the members of the supply chain. They're individual companies. I'm manufacturing it. You're warehousing it. You're retailing it. You're in for your own best interest, whatever that is. I'm in for my own best interest, whatever that is. You want your best interest. And so we're fighting one another on how much to carry, what are the costs, do we inventory now, do we inventory later, who's paying for the insurance, et cetera. Well, we're all out for our own good. Doesn't make for a very efficient system. So traditionally, the relationship between supplier, merchant, has been adversarial. Walmart, a while ago, and Walmart's obviously a pretty big player, recognized that the traditional relationship among the various players had become outmoded and actually, factually, was hurting, in this case, we're talking about the supplier and the merchant, was hurting both parties. So Walmart invited its major suppliers to jointly develop powerful supply chain partnerships. Walmart's a big player, and if we invite you to work with us, you're probably going to say yes, so I don't know how much of it is entirely free will, but you're agreeing to the partnership. And the idea, they said, is look, let's work together instead of against each other to increase the flow of the product to the consumer, to our stores, the efficiency of that flow, and so if we can increase the product flow efficiency, we'll both be more profitable. The Walmart Procter & Gamble Alliance incorporated vendor-managed inventory, category management, and other intercompany innovations to cause them to work better together. In fact, Procter & Gamble had a dedicated account team in Bentonville, Arkansas. What's that mean? Why is Bentonville, Arkansas part of the story? Bentonville, Arkansas. Say again? Who they? Yeah, it's Walmart's headquarters, corporate headquarters, thank you. Bentonville, Arkansas. Where's Procter & Gamble headquartered? Cincinnati, Ohio. They actually put an entire team out of Cincinnati, Ohio, their corporate headquarters, and moved them into Bentonville, Arkansas, Walmart's headquarters. The team members represented key Procter & Gamble functions of sales and distribution, supply chain management, and IT and finance. And that team's customer became Walmart's CFO. And Procter & Gamble's objective became maximizing Walmart's internal profitability through the flow of goods, inventory management, product management, category management. Because if Walmart had more of this going on, guess what? Procter & Gamble was doing better too. A unique idea at the time. So, a marketing channel consists of the individual and firms that are involved in the process of making a product or service available for use or consumption by consumers or industrial users. appear. I'm being basic about it, but we've got the producer. Then somehow it's got to get transported over to the wholesaler. Then it's somehow got to be transferred over to the retailer, out to the consumer. But up here at the producer, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on up here. Raw materials being created, being made, being stored, being shipped to get to the producer. This is a simplified version of the channel for us. But we know what happens when this breaks down. You ain't got the toilet paper you want. Middlemen are the business firms in a channel that render services that are directly related to the sale and purchase of a product as it flows through from the producer to the consumer. So here we're seeing the wholesaler, the retailer, our middlemen. Distribution's role within a marketing mix is to get the product to its target market when and where they want it. What do these middlemen do? Well, they can promote the product. You manufacture it, you can promote it. The wholesaler can promote it to retailers and to the general public. The retailer can promote it to the general public. They also store it, ship it, assume some of the financial risk during that distribution process. They're doing some good stuff for us. They come in two types, merchant middlemen and agent middlemen. Middlemen are commonly classified as either merchant or agent based on the basis of whether or not they take title to the products being distributed. This, we have to resonate back to our conversation last week a little bit. What does it matter who has title of the product? Talked about it a little bit last week. Who cares? The answer came from over here last time. Who cares who has title to the product? Yeah. Consumers, nah, they don't care. But thanks for asking. Who cares who has title to the product? Title implies ownership. So do we care whether it's the producer or the wholesaler or the retailer that has ownership? Who cares? Why would we care? For liability reasons. What if it gets burned up? What if it gets stolen? What if it falls out of fashion while it's in transport? Who has responsibility for the stuff? You or me? It matters. And so, merchant middlemen take title to the products that they help to market. They take the responsibility for the stuff. They own it during this process. Agent middlemen are folks who essentially are salespeople, as it were, for your company, more or less. You keep title, they sell the product, they help you make that transaction. What we say is, in general, you can eliminate the actual entity who is the middleman, but you can't eliminate the essential distribution activities they perform. Somebody still has to store it, promote it, finance it, take responsibility for the insurance, ship it. So you can eliminate the middleman, but what's that mean? Suddenly you don't have to ship it anymore? That's silly. Of course you have to ship it. Now, I created a counterexample just to make my story a little bit. Who knows Radiohead? Oh, good. So Radiohead, a while ago, admittedly, ran an interesting experiment. So Radiohead in this storyline would be who? In this channel distribution, who would Radiohead be? The middleman. So then who's providing them with the stuff? What's the stuff here? What does Radiohead do? What are they? Music. So are they the middleman for the music? What are they? They're the producer for the music. So in the music industry, who's the middleman, typically? Let's say maybe these days, but who is it? The record labels. Now again, a little less so these days, but when they ran this great experiment, the record labels were still big. You made the music, I helped to promote it, get it out there, get the discs out there, ship the, whatever they ship. Okay, so Radiohead runs a grand experiment, leading the way maybe for a new way of doing music. They indeed sort of cut out the middleman. So remember Radiohead's experiment in which they let people choose how they wanted to pay. What's going on with my screen here? Nothing simple. In which they let people choose how much they wanted to pay for the latest album in rainbows, call it a publicity stunt or an innovative business model, but the initial numbers show the experiment was a success. Now the final numbers are in, and short, rainbows sold better than their last album, selling 1.75 million copies of the physical CD, 100,000 box sets, 30,000 units on iTunes in the US. In the first week of its availability, the album was number one in both the UK and the US. For the first 3 months, it was played 17 million times on Last.fm, and even to this day, whatever this day was, it's in the top 200 UK and US. UK and US as far as sales. Yes, they're a big band. Yes, their audience is not the same as, say, Shakira's. Yes, this was one of the first such experiments. It got a great deal of attention regardless of the music. They cut out the middleman. They didn't use a record company. They went directly to the public and let them pay what they wanted. Not always the best way to do business, but sometimes you can sort of eliminate the middleman. So what do these guys do for us? Well, they engage in three types of transactions to help us out. They do transactional functions, they do logistical functions, and they do facilitating functions. And they do this on the one hand to help producers, and on the other hand to help retailers, buying agents, etc. So for the producers, they provide market information. You're sitting here in Kent, Ohio. You're a producer. What's happening in Des Moines? These guys are out there. They're on the ground. They can tell you the market conditions in Des Moines. They help you then to interpret consumers' wants, needs, desires, wherever they operate. They can help provide financing so you don't have to carry the whole burden while the thing's getting sold. They can own the product, which we've talked about. Those are all facilitating functions. In terms of transactional sorts of things, they can help to promote your product. They can negotiate downstream with the consumers. They share the risk. And in terms of logistics, they help create assortment for the consumer downstream. You want to manufacture barrels and barrels and barrels of bolts. And somebody else is making, I'm being silly here, barrels and barrels and barrels of nuts. Nobody downstream wants to buy a barrel of bolts. What do they want? They want some bolts and some nuts, maybe even in a kit with different size bolts and nuts. You don't do that. You make bolts. So what do these guys do? They help to create assortments that downstream people will want. So they do a variety of things that are nice for our friends, the producers. They also do nice things for the buyers. So as a transactional function, they can help to share the risk, to guarantee the product. In terms of logistical functions, they can do things like breaking up large quantities of a product into smaller quantities. Nobody wants a barrel of bolts. They can store the product for the buyer, warehouse it. They can transport the product so it gets to the vaulter. We create assortment. We just talked about that. And they can make the purchase, the product ready available when the retailer wants it. Finally, they can help to anticipate wants, and they can provide financing. If they don't do those things, who's going to do them? You? So they do a variety of things that bring value. This was a little silly example, but anybody been to the Kent stage to hear a band? Anybody know about the Kent stage? Okay, just curious. So my little storyline here, not that exciting, was the Kent stage. You wanted to hear your favorite band who's going to, could play at the Kent stage, but you want them to play. So how's that going to happen? You call them up and say, hey, this is Larry. Yeah, yeah. Can you play for me next week at my place? No. That's just silly. So in this example of getting your music heard, the Kent stage is your middleman. They arrange for what people in the area want to listen to, so they're providing information on who wants what, a venue, a place for this to happen, tickets, promotion, and you're able to see your favorite, hear your favorite band, because these guys operate as the middleman between the band and you. Excuse me. Distribution channels include the people and firms involved in the transfer of title to a product as the product moves from the producer to the ultimate consumer or the business user in the B2B world. So transfer of title we've talked about is being a bit important. So this is the idea of moving title from producer to middleman to final consumer or business unit. The channel for a product extends only to the last person or organization that buys that thing without making any significant change in its form. If the form of the thing is altered and another product emerges, then we have a new channel of distribution because you aren't transferring the title of the thing anymore. It's something different. For example, if you are in the furniture industry, where does it all start? Well, I presume with trees. It's for a lot of furniture companies. So you have a lumber mill making big trees into boards and whatever. And those boards or whatever are sold to furniture makers through a broker. So the channel of distribution, lumber mill, broker, furniture maker. But of course, when you're done with the furniture, you don't suddenly have boards unless you're, who's that, IKEA that makes you put everything together? You actually have a piece of furniture, right? New product, new channel of distribution. So now, from the furniture maker, like Artistica, we sell our furniture out through a furniture store to the ultimate consumer. One channel of distribution, the thing is significantly changed to a new product, a second channel of distribution emerges. There are other intermediaries out there that help all this stuff happen. Financing we mentioned. Who's going to finance you while you're waiting for the product to be sold so you can get actual cash? The bank. Insurance companies, who's going to take responsibility for that risk? You have the title, the insurance company. Obviously, transportation companies are going to help move that product from one place to another. So those are other intermediaries we might be interested in. So we have two main types of business we know about, B2C and B2B. So we can think about consumer marketing channels on the left, and we can think about business marketing channels on the right. And these channels involve flow types of ownership, of payment, of information, and of promotion. So let's take a little peek at this. The channel, to be a channel, has to have a consumer and a producer. If you only had a producer without anybody buying the product, you're not in a very good business. And you're not a channel. Somebody has to be buying what you're selling. And if your consumer wants something, but there's nobody producing it, there's no real channel there. So it has to have a buyer and a producer. Now, if it only has a buyer and a producer, it's called a direct channel. So as you perhaps know, Tesla does not sell its cars through dealerships. You order directly from the company. It's a D2C, direct to consumer model. Over here on the right side is a business-to-business example from a company called New Pig. Not testable, but I'll tell you briefly the story of New Pig. Anybody ever work in a factory floor by any chance? No. So if you work in a factory floor, there's almost always going to be lubricant around, oil and grease. And the floor gets slippery and dangerous. You can't have people, workers falling and stuff. You don't want that mess all over. So in the old days, what they used to do is go get a shovel full of sawdust, throw it on the oil and grease, and somebody would have to sweep it up or scrape it up or whatever. It wasn't a very good way of doing things. So these guys, in the early days, took nylon stockings, hose, whatever, I don't know if they're actual nylon, but you know what I'm talking about. cut the legs off them, stuff them with sawdust, and put them where the oil and grease would drip, and it would absorb it up into this sausage, pig sausage, get it, into this stuff. And informally, this turned out to be really good. And so they made a company out of it. And in the early days, New Pig would sell directly from the producer to the business customer, a B2C direct marketing scheme. They changed that over time, but there you go. So as an example of producer to consumer, the D2C, many online companies use this channel. Tesla sells its cars directly to consumers. You can go to Dell and customize your order directly from Dell. This was strange when it first came out, buying a mattress online. Has anybody bought a mattress online? It's suddenly a big thing. It's like, what? When you first hear about it, it's like, what are you talking about? You don't go to a store, you don't lay on it, see how you like it or whatever. Nah, it comes in the mail. Okay, obviously that's work. Dollar Shave Club, anybody a Dollar Shave Club guy or gal? No? Subscription-based service, delivers razors and other grooming products directly to its customers' doors. Everlane sells clothing, accessories, and shoes directly to consumers online. So that's a channel of distribution, producer, consumer, direct. If you have at least one intermediary between the producer and the consumer, you have an indirect channel of distribution. So can you buy directly from Dell? You can. What kind of channel is that? Direct. Can you buy a Dell computer through Walmart or fill in a bunch of other stores? Yes. What kind of channel is that? It's an indirect channel of distribution. Over here on the B2B side, most of those folks would buy it directly from Dell in a direct channel of distribution. So from the producer through a retailer to a consumer like Walmart or Target is a B2C indirect channel. The retailer has direct dealings with the producer. And I mentioned earlier, Walmart is a big player. If you're a producer for Walmart, you pay attention to what they say of necessity, as do other leading retailers. Target talks to its producers pretty directly as they arrange for things to happen. You also can have an indirect channel that's a bit more complex, a producer to a wholesaler, then to a retailer, then to the consumer. So you're a small retailer, you're not a Target, you're not a Walmart. How in the world do you get all the products that you need in your store? You're running a store. You're going to go call 500 different suppliers. Hey, I need this, I need this, I need this. That's a little crazy. But there are wholesalers who combine things, put them together, assort them, and make them available to you. Makes your life easier to do. So for thousands of small worlds, this is the only economically feasible way to market your products, by a wholesaler who serves your industry. On the B2B side, producer to business consumer is the direct channel of distribution, and as you can see, I have there underlined. It's a larger dollar volume of business than any other channel arrangement around. Why is that? Because that's how businesses buy really big, expensive things. Direct. You don't go to your local distributor and buy a couple dozen helicopters or an oil rig. That's not how it happens. You buy it directly from the producer. So large installations, jet engines, helicopters, elevators are almost always sold to the business customer directly from producer. So it's a very large dollar volume compared to all other channels of distribution. We also can have an intermediary here for an indirect channel. So we can go from a producer through a distributor, which is like a wholesaler, but on the business side, to our business customers. So this indirect approach is often used for smaller objects, operating supplies, small accessory equipment that businesses need all the time. They need them, they replace them, they get more of them. Anybody ever see a Granger? Does that look familiar at all? A Granger truck anywhere? Maybe a Granger store, which is B2B? No, never. Maybe you see it now that I pointed it out. So Granger is a business distributor. Their catalog includes such offerings as motors, lighting, material handling, fasteners, plumbing, tools, safety supplies. Their revenue is generally from business-to-business sales rather than consumer sales. They're like a big wholesaler for business customers, selling all kinds of things that they need to run their business. And again, the business customer doesn't want to call up 20, 30, 50, 100, 150 different businesses to get nuts, bolts, connectors, tapes, plumbing supplies. Then we can go on the B2B side, from producer to manufacturer's rep or a sales branch, to a distributor, to a business customer. This indirect approach is often used by those who, that's an odd spelling, by those who don't have the resources to call directly on their customers. So a minute ago we were talking about the small business not having enough resources to go contact all those producers. What if you're a small producer in Kent, Ohio? How are you going to reach thousands of businesses out there in the country? I don't know. I can't very well be calling them. This is where you go through a manufacturer's rep. They're going to talk to all these business distributors throughout the company who buy and sell lots of stuff down to that ultimate consumer. So that's a B2B indirect channel. Now, of course, life changes. E-commerce, digital distribution, other internet age developments have added a new way to get products and services to consumers directly, B2B and B2C. So businesses can operate both bricks and mortar shops and online stores. Digital-only services may be downloaded directly from the provider or distributed through a value-added reseller. So we've got to introduce technology into this channel of distribution idea. Often it's going to mean we're involved now in a direct channel of distribution. For example, it may not be surprising that the video game industry has shifted over the past 20 years. 20 years ago, how would you get your game? Anybody get games 20 years ago? 20 years ago, you probably had to go to a physical store to buy your game or maybe use a mail order service. Anybody ever been in a GameStop? It's an actual physical place where you can actually buy physical product. Holy mackerel. Used to be that was the only way to get your physical product. So, producer to the retailer to the consumer. And then early on, the internet came along and companies started selling those products online. The Sega Channel was an online game service developed by Sega for Genesis system. And it served as a content delivery system directly from the producer. From 94 to 98, the Sega Channel was provided to the public by TCI and Time Warner Cable through cable television services, through coax cable, not that fast, I guess. Today, services like Steam, who uses Steam at all for their gaming, like Steam provide video game digital distribution, essentially, here we go, cutting out the middleman, where the middleman is defined as the bricks and mortar retailer, although there's still GameStops around. The rise of e-commerce markets like Amazon added another major channel of distribution. After following Bezos' initial business plan, the company expanded into selling computer games and music in 98. Selling electronics helped the company to grow rapidly and put traditional electronics stores like Circuit City. Anybody ever remember a Circuit City? You do. Wow. Okay. You're an old soul. Circuit City. Replaced by Best Buy by now, certainly. Like Circuit City, out of business. So Amazon also in the mix for those electronics. With faster networks, gamers can cut out their middleman and physical media entirely by downloading video games through distribution services like Steam. But bricks and mortar stores, e-commerce retailers, and online shops still remain a viable distribution channel, and video game companies need to factor all of them in order to reach their widest audiences. So our channel of distribution can be bigger than we might think it would be. Omnichannel marketing is the integration and cooperation of the various channel organizations that organizations use to interact with consumers with the goal of creating a consistent brand experience. This is going to include the physical stores and the digital channels and all the elements within those two things. The intent is to create a convenient, seamless user experience for customers that offer many opportunities to buy the product or the service. For example, this multi-channel or omni-channel marketing strategy may give consumers the chance to find a product online, purchase it online or in store, or in combination, such as a buy online and pick up in store BOPSIS option. How many of you guys have done that? You've bought it online, picked it up in the store, very convenient, very nice. But a few years ago, people would say, what are you talking about? What? Either you buy it online or you buy it in the store. What do you mean buy it online, pick it up in the store? Stores then have had to adapt their channel of distribution to account for this new consumer behavior. Walmart, Target, Best Buy, Home Depot, Apple, Nordstrom's, PetSmart, and more have all done this BOPSIS approach. Multi-channel or multiple distribution channels are one way to reach two or more target markets, and it avoids total dependence on a single channel arrangement. Not testable because I don't have all the facts in front of me, but I was told a bunch of years ago in the Philippines, Pepsi had a single distributor. There was one channel of distribution to reach all of the Philippines. By the way, the Philippines is big. One channel of distribution to reach the Philippines. And something had happened, and the partnership fell apart. They couldn't distribute Pepsi in the Philippines at all. They only had one way to do it. I imagine now they have more than one channel of distribution. So, we might have two or more channels of distribution to get out there. For example, a manufacturer through a wholesaler to a retailer and also have a company store. Or a manufacturer to a wholesaler to a retailer and sell online. Or if we're a show producer, we might produce the shows and distribute it both through cable TV and streaming like HBO does. So we're trying to meet a couple different target markets using different channels and not relying only on one. In 2022, most of Apple's sales, 62%, came from indirect channels made up of third-party cellular networks, wholesalers, retailers, and resellers. These channels are critical for sales amplification, scale, and subsidies to enable the iPhone to be purchased by many people. The direct channel, who's been to an Apple store ever? Okay. The direct channel represented only 38% of the total revenues of Apple. Stores are critical for customer experience, enabling the service, business, and branding at scale in that store. Apple stores are quite interesting, but you can also buy Apple from indirect channels. So we started talking about the old ways of distribution before Walmart said, hey, this is inefficient. So we can talk a little bit about the conventional ways of distributing products and something called vertical marketing systems. So historically, distribution channels, as we said, stressed the independence of the individual members. The producer was out to do whatever was best for them. The wholesaler was out to do whatever was best for them. The retailer, whatever was best for them. So this focused on those individual entities needs and objectives, not very efficient. We had to learn to get around that.
You've said you've had many mentors along the way. Can you single out one who gave you the best leadership advice ever?
Bob Jagger. I was an electronics buyer at Macy's, California. And I was going for the jugular with every one of my vendors in every negotiation that I was making. And I was putting wins on the board. And he pulled me by the ear out of a meeting one day. He basically told me, you will win every battle, but you're going to lose this war. You've got to create win-win partnerships or you're never going to be successful in this business. And that was a game changer for me. And I started to say, okay, I'm going to put myself in the partner's shoes in every single negotiation. And that has shaped my win-win business partnership strategy ever since. So what I'm known for is collaboration, and I will tell you that was a seminal moment in my career that he taught me.
So you can't be out for yourself alone every time. You're just making enemies. Over time, people are going to want to work with you. They'll find other ways of doing business. How about a collaborative partnership thing where we both benefit, and maybe the customer benefits too, says Jeffrey Gannett, CEO at Macy's. So the coronavirus has accelerated the consumer shift to e-commerce, and forecasts are that many department stores will shutter for good. To deliver steady long-term growth, we believe our brands can no longer rely on malls or department stores to drive traffic. Brands have to generate their own audiences and become destinations themselves. So we'll see what happens over time to places like Macy's. So the conventional approach is what he was doing when he first got on board. Producer, wholesaler, retailer, all focused on their own goals and objectives, beating each other up whenever they could. The more modern way of thinking about this is through a VMS, a vertical marketing system, where the producer and the wholesaler and the retailer either formally, sometimes by ownership, or informally through partnering relationships, work together to provide more efficient, effective delivery of goods and services. So they tightly coordinate their activities to improve the operating efficiency, the marketing efficiency. Everyone benefits, including the consumer. So what are some examples of these vertical marketing systems? Well, one broad example is a corporate vertical marketing system owned by one company. Anybody ever been to Manhattan and seen a Nike store by any chance? Well, when you go into a Nike store in Manhattan, guess what brands you see? Wild guess. Adidas. No, that's not right. You see Nike. They own the channel. Everything, virtually. Everything in there is Nike. Yeah? So, Kroger's is a vertical marketing system. Sherwin-Williams, you go into Sherwin-Williams store. When it comes to paints, anyhow, what you see is Sherwin-Williams. Luxottica, I'm going to talk about Luxottica in a few minutes. So we have a corporate-owned situation, and the reason that they work so well together is they're owned by one company. Yeah? Luxottica has the vertical integration of design, production, distribution of glasses. It's unique in the industry. Luxottica Company, together with some long-lasting partnerships with leading luxury and fashion brands, provides outstanding results through a vertical integrated marketing channel. So they own and do R&D and design for glasses, sunglasses, regular glasses. They do the early development that we talked about when we talked about new products, product development. So they do the prototype and the industrialization. They produce optical lenses. They produce sunglasses, which are lens processing. They produce frames. Eyeglasses come out. They then distribute the product through their retail stores. So they do the shipping, they do the warehousing, they do the category management. Then they sell the product through their own retail stores as well as some independent distributors out to the ultimate customer. Things work pretty well. They own the entire channel. And it's somewhat unique. We'll return to them later on in a little bit. We, however, can have just people that work together, not because of ownership, but because we have a legal contract. We agree to work together legally. So, for example, Midas, a franchise type thing. If you own a Midas muffler shop, you can't be selling Amoco mufflers by contract. Independent Grocers of America is an organization where a bunch of grocers have gotten together and worked with distributors to supply products. So then there are administered vertical marketing systems. This is where you just agree because of the power of the brand to work along with them. Although you can find some very unique grocery stores, think Whole Foods. Who's been to Whole Foods? Whole Foods, you don't typically see Kraft products at Whole Foods, right? But if you're a regular grocery store, can you imagine being a regular grocery store and not carrying any Kraft products or P&G products? What? Not really. So why do you agree to go along with it? They're big. People come to your store for them. So these are administered vertical marketing systems where you work with those folks just because they're international leaders. Consumers expect you to carry those products there. So that would be an administrated vertical marketing system, a third approach to it. Well, with this sort of channel of distribution decisions, you can begin to head scratch a little bit. How many should I have? Seems like there's a lot of choices here. How many channels should I have? And of course, the answer is often the same in this domain. What is the optimal intensity for your product? You need just enough middlemen to meet the desires of the target market. Do you remember us talking about selective distribution versus intensive distribution? If you're selling chewing gum, how many retail outlets do you want? A few or a lot? Whole bunch, wherever they buy products. If you're selling Lamborghinis, you don't need to be everywhere. So, anything that goes beyond just enough to meet the desire of the target market, you're wasting profit, you're wasting your resources, you're wasting the money. So there's no one answer. Depends on your situation, is how many. As we think about this intensity of distribution, it's not just one decision. It's at the producer level. It's at the wholesaler level. It's at the retail level. We have to decide at each channel level what we want. We might want intensive retail coverage, but only selective wholesale distribution, given our industry. And this takes us back to what we were just talking about, what I was just alluding to. You need intensive retail distribution for convenience goods. I want to tell a little story here, and I'm running out of voice and running out of time. Let's just hold this here. Another awkward break, because this is the end of the material for test 12, which will open tomorrow. But I think we'll just wait for the rest of the story until next time. All right? New test coming up. See you next time.